Okay. So now I'm going to talk about the Open Philanthropy Project. So basically the story of the Open Philanthropy Project. So Ellie and I founded GiveWell in 2007. And then in 2011, we met Carrie Tuna and Dustin Moskovitz. Dustin is the co-founder of Facebook and Asana. And they were asking kind of a similar question to what had made us start GiveWell, but very different also. So when we started GiveWell, we were asking, you know, hey, I want to give a few thousand dollars. I have a few hours to think about it. What do I do to do the most good? And they were asking more something like, we are giving away billions of dollars. We have our whole lives to think about this, you know, all the time. What do we do to do the most good? So that is, you know, a question we obviously found very interesting and had a similar challenge around it in the sense that, you know, if you want to read people arguing about how to, you know, what our public policy should be, what our trade policy should be, there's an infinite amount to read, but if you want to read, you know, opinions, argument, reasoning about how to do the most good with your money, there's like almost nothing. And it's very hard to get up to speed, to learn, to hear what the important questions are. And so with Open Phil, like with GiveWell, we decided to, you know, we wanted to work with Carrie and Dustin in partnership. So their foundation is called Good Ventures, and our joint collaboration is called Open Phil. Open Phil is going to become its own organization soon, I think now, in a few months, but right now still part of GiveWell. But as with GiveWell, we were going to kind of go on a journey of answering that question for ourselves, of figuring out where to give to do the most good, and of writing about what we did as we went so that other people could get up to speed faster in the future and wouldn't have to reinvent the wheel. So in that sense, it's like the same mission as GiveWell. You know, do the most good with your money and help other people understand what you're doing. The way in which it's different is, you know, obviously the two kinds of giving, I think, are very different, and I think they call for very different approaches. And I think, you know, there's a few differences between giving at a very large level and giving at a smaller level. One is, you know, at the very large level, there's a lot of things you can do that other people can't do. So you can create new organizations. You can allow organizations to build in whole new programs or go in whole new directions that they weren't going to otherwise. But I think the most important difference is I just think there's a huge difference between spending all your time thinking about how to give and building a network of trusted staff or advisors versus trying to figure it out in, you know, a day a year or a few hours a year, even a week a year. That's what I think the really biggest difference is, and I think that leads to different fits. So I think when you're giving at that larger level, it makes more sense to do things that might look, you know, might look crazy to other people. Do things that are very long term. Do things where you don't have the evidence and you aren't going to know how things are going for a very long time. And so what you need instead is a lot of context, a lot of expertise, a lot of connections so that you can make the kind of softer judgments about what's worth doing and get, you know, knowledgeable enough in an area or get enough of a trust network that you can do things that you believe in and others don't. And so that's what I would say the fundamental difference is between Open Phil and GiveWell is that approach. And I think there's pros and cons. So I think, you know, people often find GiveWell unsatisfying because they say, can't you do more? Can't you take bigger risks? Can't you think more ambitiously? But when people hear about Open Phil, they often kind of have the opposite reaction. Like, this is too weird. This doesn't make sense. This isn't going to work. And so I think it's, you know, always good to think about what kind of donor you're trying to be. And, you know, I think that different things make sense for people with different kinds of networks and different amounts of time to give. So to talk about what Open Phil does, basically I'm just, you know, up until 2015, our main goal was to pick focus areas. And that was a matter of deciding what issues we were going to work on, what causes. And I think it is very important to have focus areas. I think it's very important to say, you know, these are the topics I'm going to think about the most, that I'm going to become an expert in, that I'm going to know people in, and so that I don't have to rethink everything from the ground up every time I see a new grant proposal. And, you know, I think it's especially important for, like, building relationships, that if you have good relationships in a field, you can get a kind of truth that you can't get otherwise. And in certain fields where you don't have evidence, that can be very important. And so we tried to pick focus areas. And what we did is we looked at a lot of different areas we might work in. So we made a list of, like, all of the U.S. policy issues where we might try to make policy better. And so that can include, like, immigration policy, criminal justice policy, climate policy, et cetera. And we looked at, you know, a whole bunch of other different kinds of causes, and we asked three questions about every cause we considered. We said, is this important, is it neglected, and is it tractable? So important means, you know, we're working on an issue where if we are successful, it will be a huge deal. It will affect a lot of persons. It will affect them a lot. Neglected means, you know, it's not already covered. This isn't already flooded in philanthropic money. There's value for us to add here. And then tractable means when we look at the actual activities we would do, we think they, you know, have a chance of working. And that's important as well. And so what we did in 2014 is we made a large list of all the areas we might specialize in. And we did short investigations, shallow investigations, where we quickly got a rough sense of how important, neglected, and tractable different issues are. Then for issues that stood out, we went a bit deeper, and eventually we chose issues, and we said, these are the issues we're gonna focus on. And then we basically spent all of 2015 building staff around the choices we'd made. And this is an example of why it's important, I think, to have focus areas and to be careful about how you choose them. Because, you know, once we decided we wanted to work in criminal justice reform, we were able to hire Chloe Coburn after a really long search, who, you know, was at the ACLU, has a background in criminal justice, knows a lot about criminal justice, wouldn't have come to us to work on another issue, but for criminal justice, like, can bring a level of expertise and context and connections that we just, like, do not have ourselves. And so, you know, what we did in 2015 was really try to build that team around those causes. And then in 2016 was the first year that we really felt we do have the team. Now we want to focus on actually making grants. So OpenPhil's been around for several years, and I would say this is the first year that we really focused on making grants. We have made grants in the past. So, you know, to put some numbers on it, in 2015, total grant making, like recommended by the Open Philanthropy Project, was in the range of about $15 million. That does not include the top charities, and I'm not including that in any of this. And in 2016, I'm expecting it'll be at or near $100 million. So there's, you know, a big growth there. In terms of the actual areas we work in, you know, just to give a really quick flavor of what areas we work in and what we've done so far. So there's criminal justice reform. We chose that because compared to a lot of other US policy issues, it was unusually tractable. And what I mean by that is that, you know, in a lot of political issues, it's a big, like, it's very partisan and it's a very big challenge to come in and make a difference. And in criminal justice reform, I think there's some unusual dynamics where, you know, there was a big rise in incarceration in the US a couple decades ago, and it was really unprecedented, and it left the US incarcerating a massive number of people relative to other countries. And we've gotten to a point now where crime is way down. We don't believe that's because of the rise in incarceration, but it does make incarceration kind of less attractive to people. State budgets are tight, and you've kind of got this rare opportunity to, in some cases, I would say, bring conservatives and liberals together, and in other cases, just find like a little bit easier ground than might have existed in the past for reforms. And you know, this is one of the few areas in US policy where it just, you know, it looks like you can help some of the worst off people by cutting the size of government, and that can often be good, you know. Another good thing about criminal justice reform is it's a state and local issue, so you can pick your battles a lot more than if you're just, you know, something like immigration, it's DC only. Of course, we are also interested in immigration, but I'm kind of keeping things on the shortish side here. So Chloe leads our criminal justice reform work. She also manages Michelle Krenzel, who helps her with that work, and that was basically Chloe leading the process of hiring her. Chloe is, you know, in terms of our process, Chloe leads our work completely. So she talks to everyone, she hears the ideas people are having, she uses her own personal individual judgment to say what is most worth doing, and then she writes up the case for a grant she wants to make. We give her guidance on how much total we're looking to kind of grant out in that area, and then we read the case, we talk it over with her, we try to sync up with her. In some cases, and we being like the final decision makers on grants are currently myself and Carrie Tuna. And, you know, in some cases we get completely convinced and we reach agreement and we make the grant. And in other cases we might not be so convinced, but we'll make it anyway because of trust. And as long as that ratio is not too far out of whack, we feel good. And so, you know, basically first year of Chloe was something around $10 to $15 million in grants for criminal justice reform. And then for year two, it's going to be more than that. And some of the things we've done, you know, we funded the Alliance for Safety and Justice, which is the national expansion of the Californians for Safety and Justice group that was behind Prop 47 and later Prop 57 in California, two of the biggest incarceration reduction bills that have been passed in a long time. Also have been supporting a campaign to close Rikers Jail in New York, and that's not just about moving people from one jail to another. In order to close that jail, you need to change policies, and you need to have fewer people sitting in jail for less time. And then we've also, you know, done some things to support alternatives to incarceration, so longer term, more ambitious. Restorative justice is an approach to, you know, an approach to handling violent offenses or nonviolent offenses where the person who committed the offense and the victim meet and kind of make a deal with each other. And that can be an alternative to kind of going to prison. Another important point on criminal justice is we did have the question, what is the trade-off? Like, obviously, if fewer people are incarcerated, that's fewer people suffering, and that's less money being spent by the state. But does that also mean we're less, you know, there's less public safety? And so David Rudman, who I mentioned before, spent about a year going through all the literature on the relationship between incarceration and crime. His results are not public yet, but they will be, and they're pretty close to final. And it was really interesting. So he, you know, basically found all the studies with the best claim to actually looking at whether reducing incarceration would cause an increase in crime, and looking at it in a sophisticated way and trying not to get it confused with correlation. And when he looked at them hard enough and he got the data and he replicated them, a lot of the studies kind of either fell apart or their conclusions reversed. But when you look at the whole thing in aggregate, his overall conclusion was that on the current margin, with the way things are in the US today, the very high levels of incarceration, he would expect a zero impact of getting less incarceration. So in other words, if you have fewer people in prison, you will have less suffering, you will have less money, and as far as we can tell, you shouldn't really expect more crime. And so that, you know, definitely points toward the kind of reforms we're working toward, and that whole report will be out in all its gory detail. And then, you know, other causes we work in, so we work on farm animal welfare. So this is a cause, you know, there's a very, very large number of animals being treated incredibly cruelly on factory farms, you know, basically to produce meat and eggs and animal products for people to eat. And, you know, I think there's a lot of room for debate on how much you should care about the experiences of animals compared to humans. And there's a lot of arguments one can have on this. And actually, you know, sort of in a similar style, we've been working on a big, long, detailed, confusing report about how you should feel about that question. But I will say that, you know, if you do take the position, and I think it's an at least reasonable or defensible or possible position, that you should care about animals some fraction as much as humans, then I think the things we've been finding in farm animal welfare are just like incredibly good deals. So, you know, earlier I talked about top charities. BedNets estimate that you might be able to prevent an infant death for every $2,000 or $3,000. With farm animal welfare, the work we've been doing, it might be something more like 50 to 100 chickens are no longer in a cage for their entire life per $1. And so that is, you know, quite a multiplier. And I think I value humans more than chickens. But it's worth asking by how much. And that is a question I feel very confused about. And so I'm glad that, you know, that we are doing this work. I think it's been very exciting. Lewis Bollard leads our work. And he came to us with the insight that there is a lot of room to make a lot of progress on corporate campaigns here. And so basically, you know, in his opinion, if you go to a fast food company or a, you know, image conscious grocer, and you say, you basically are protesting what they're doing and giving them a choice of either having their brand tarnished or making a pledge to go cage free, it turns out that they go cage free a lot of the time. There's been a huge wave of cage-free pledges. You know, taking chickens out of cages definitely does not put them in conditions that I feel good about, but it definitely is better than them being in the cages. And, you know, basically, if there's been a wave of pledges over the last year by the groups that we've been funding, or the groups we've been funding have been pushing for those pledges. We believe they've largely caused those pledges. And if all those pledges are adhered to, it's like approximately all the eggs in America will be cage-free. In 10 or 20 years. And so that's been, you know, just massive size wins. And since seeing all those pledges, we've been taking the work international as well, trying to fund cage-free campaigns in Europe, in Latin America, and also trying to get things started in China. Just, you know, China's where a huge amount of factory farming is going to be, and so we've just been trying to build up anyone who seems to be doing useful work there, just to build the field and just to get more wins there. And have recently started, you know, also looking at meat chickens, broiler chickens, how they're treated, and looking at fish as well, which, you know, should we care about fish? Well, again, there will be a giant confusing report on this soon. So that's our farm animal welfare work. Other work, there's biosecurity and pandemic preparedness. So this gets into the topic of global catastrophic risks, but, you know, basically we think that philanthropy is uniquely well suited to take on things that are very unlikely, but if they happened could kind of derail all of human civilization, because it's really not clear who else has the incentive to worry about that kind of thing. And so, you know, Jamie Yassif and Howie Lempel are our biosecurity and pandemic preparedness team. And they, you know, their work is newer and a lot of the grants aren't public yet, but basically have been funding, you know, in our opinion, in their opinion, a lot of the best work on kind of thinking through how the world can be better prepared for the worst case pandemics, especially if and when the state of synthetic biology advances so that, you know, by accident or maybe by maliciousness, you could get the kind of pandemics that we've never seen in the past. And so that's, you know, obviously work that's hard to do a cost effectiveness calculation on, but it's work that we've been doing nonetheless. And then a final cause that I'll talk about is potential risk for advanced artificial intelligence. This is also in the category, you know, I would say there's kind of two schools of thought in how to help people the most with your money. One is to focus on the people who are the most marginalized, the most suffering, the worst off. And that is a common theme of kind of the Give All Top Charities, of the animal work, of the criminal justice reform in a sense. And, you know, another school of thought about how to do the most good is to focus on giant leverage factors that could affect how human civilization progresses, kind of like far into the future. And pandemics is one thing that could influence that, especially as biology advances. And then another thing is artificial intelligence. I consider AI to be one of the most dynamic and unpredictable areas of science right now. There have been, you know, in the last 5 years or so, problems that seemed impossible and seemed like things that only humans can do, like tagging images, and in some places playing video games, just by looking at the screen or, you know, learning how to play them just by, without having a lot of data other than what's on the screen. Those problems have been kind of, we've seen surprising success on them. And there's kind of a new set of approaches in AI, where, you know, the combination of state-of-the-art hardware and a certain kind of approach called deep learning has produced a lot of really big breakthroughs on previously really difficult problems. And so how far is this going to go? We don't really know. It could be that this is just a flash in the pan that improves voice recognition and image recognition and nothing else really comes of it. It could be that large numbers of the percentages of the current economy become automated, and that could have kind of unpredictable consequences for the world. And it could be that we get even more extreme effects where, you know, I would say that the reason humans have so much more impact on and control over the planet than other animals certainly seems to be intelligence rather than any particular physical ability. And so if there were something that kind of, if there were an AI that were able to outperform humans at some of the highest stakes tasks, such as doing science, I think the consequences of that are extremely unpredictable. And so what we've been trying to do with potential risk for advanced AI is encourage the growth of a subfield of artificial intelligence research, which is AI safety research. What we've been trying to do is encourage a world where there's a large critical mass of AI researchers that are good both at thinking about how to make algorithms more powerful, but how to make them more reliable, more robust, more stable, and how to think through what impacts they might have on society. And I think that's the kind of thing that, you know, it's a long ways off. It might never matter. Even if it does matter, the work we're doing now could easily just be like in the wrong direction or with the wrong emphasis. But if it does matter, could, you know, be so world-changing that the numbers are like competitive with or better than all the other stuff I've talked about tonight. So those are some samples of the work we're doing. You know, we also have supported some groups that are in the effective altruism community. So those are groups that are doing work around the general idea of trying to spread the concept of doing as much good as you can, whether that's with your career or with your money or with other things. And then we've, you know, we've done a series of one-off grants as well when we see especially good opportunity pop up. So, you know, Some of those have been on climate or, you know, other global catastrophic risks and miscellaneous other things. I had a couple other notes I want to say about Open Phil, and then I will pause for questions. We are, like I said, we're spinning out as a separate organization. We're kind of already talking about Open Phil as a separate organization. It's not formally done yet. I think about a year ago, I said I hoped it would be a year, but I wasn't sure. Now I'm pretty confident it'll be less than a year, and I'm probably aiming for like something like 6 months. And we're definitely actively working on that. And in terms of what's going forward for Open Phil, I think that, giving went up a lot this year. I don't think the priority next year is to hire like a bunch more program officers and do a bunch, you know, expand it even more. I think the priority more is to say, you know, we're facing a lot of decisions we didn't used to face. We're facing a lot of challenges we didn't used to face. We have a lot of questions about how to compare this kind of giving to that kind of giving. We have a lot of process issues of just like wanting a better developed operations team, communications team, logistics team. And so I think the focus of the next year is probably to keep giving roughly around the same level, keep staff roughly around the same level, though I think we want to be looking into hiring more operations staff and generally just getting a lot of our, you know, we've got a better sense for what some of the big questions are that we need to struggle with, and getting our best thinking on those out there and written down so that we can work from it. That's a lot of the priority that I want for the next year. So that's basically the Open Phil, you know, story and update. And now I'll just take questions for the rest of the time. Yep.
On AI, I think there's the whole like safety and side that we're not sure, but there's the side that we're pretty sure that like they're gonna take jobs away, and then like that would be pretty much middle level, and that will increase inequality. And I think that's a pretty almost for sure assumption that will happen, and it is happening. So what do we do about this increasing inequality that
causes? Right, so what do we do about, you know, the possibility, or you're, you know, you're kind of saying it's more than a possibility that AI will lead to automation of jobs and increasing inequality. I tend to agree that, you know, I don't know exactly how much automation is coming in the next 20 years or really what the exact consequences will be. Rising inequality seems to me like a pretty good bet as one of the consequences. I think there are some, there's a whole bunch of questions you could have with that as a jumping off point. I mean, you could have debates over what the best policy response is. What is, you know, should we have a universal basic income? Should we have some alternative to universal basic income, et cetera? We are interested in that stuff. I would say on the AI front, probably the work that I find most relevant to all the other stuff we're doing and relevant to that is this idea of road mapping. So, you know, having a better forecast of which jobs are going to be kind of like doable by AI and when. I don't think we're ever going to know that, but I think we do a better job guessing than we currently are, and that might inform policy debates and make them more sophisticated. So that's, you know, that's an example of like an interest there. Yep.
Are you guys looking into lobbying governments to increase funding to the type of charities supported by the classic GiveWell? So for example, people estimate that $1 spent in lobbying yield like $80 to $130 of government giving, and you could really imagine like buying a nice steak dinner to some state legislators and induce them to pass a bill and stuff. So yeah. Are you guys looking into that?
Yeah, have we looked into lobbying or, you know, just advocating to governments that they, you know, do more funding for foreign aid, for the most effective kinds of foreign aid? We have looked into that. That was a cause that we looked into as a potential focus area. I think there is like a, you know, a pretty sizable already advocacy world of groups trying to make the case to the government that foreign aid and especially health aid is good. So I think it would be a little hard for us to find like an incredibly compelling niche there. We have done some funding on this front. So, you know, Center for Global Development is a group that is a think tank, and they try to come up with ways in which rich country policies could be better and more beneficial to poor countries. We think they do really good work, and you know, they were a group that we gave, you know, sort of made an early grant to support their work, but it's not a focus area of ours because we, you know, when we looked at importance, neglectedness, and tractability, we felt that there were other areas that just made more sense for us to focus on.
And did you actually keep track or document the process of like how you narrowed down the list? So, for example, if we had a similar idea as you started with a few years ago, we'll be able to look up your reasoning.
Yeah, did we document the process of how we chose? Yeah, we did. If you go to openphilanthropy.org and you go, I think it's under the research top nav, then you go to our process. That's where it's just going to walk through step by step. And don't miss, there's a couple links that go to spreadsheets, and the spreadsheets actually show like the causes that we seriously investigated, how we feel about the importance of neglectedness and tractability, you know, with global catastrophic risks, some things about like what the worst case scenarios are and stuff like that. So we, you know, we didn't document it exhaustively. And one important thing about OpenPhil that is different from GiveWell is it's not as well documented. It's just not as tractable to document at all. GiveWell is really there to serve people who want all the information out on the web where everyone can look at it and critique it even if they're not going to read it themselves. GiveWell has a high ratio of like writing to deciding. OpenPhil, we make a larger number of grants, and a lot of times it's like, I believe this person because I've gotten to know them for a long time and had a lot of conversations with them. They believe a lot of other people, and like documenting the whole thing would just be impossible. So right. OpenPhil, I mean, we try to, I think what we do accomplish, what I hope we accomplish, is that you can see at a high level how we're thinking. You can see what our process looks like, what criteria we're using, what our basic reasoning is, where you're likely to have a disagreement, what might be worth drilling down on. But we definitely do not have our thinking documented in the exhaustive level of detail that GiveWell has. So that's, you know, that's a difference. Yep.
About a year ago, OpenPhil published a report on cultured meat. And I think the conclusion was something like OpenPhil did not see like a path to becoming cost effective because
yep.
the media, like the media that the meat grows in, like it, the animal-free media, like it's very hard to do cost-effectively.
Yeah.
Like based on the knowledge we have. So is that is OpenPhil, like, are there any updates to that, or is that like still the conclusion, or is it?
Yeah. A while ago, we looked into cultured meat, which is this idea of kind of using stem cells from animals to basically grow meat in a dish, just, like grow muscles, so that you don't have to, you know. I think if you could do this cheaply, you would have, you know, lower carbon emissions, you would have lower environmental footprint, you'd have less animal suffering, you'd have like a lot of the abuses of factory farms, which they really are problematic in a number of ways, you could just get rid of. And so we looked into whether there was promise in funding the science of how to do that. You know, we ended up coming away just like not very enthusiastic about that area, for the reasons you said, that we just didn't see a path to it becoming cheap. And it's not just the animal-free media. There's like a lot of things you'd have to do, all of which are just like really expensive right now. And so you'd have to like find a way to do like a lot of different things very cheaply. I'm not going to say it's impossible. I'm going to say that like we didn't really talk to anyone who seemed to have much of a vision of how to get there. We didn't really feel that we had much of a case for tractability at all. We felt that we could do better putting our energy elsewhere. And that includes, actually, we're more optimistic about people who are making better meat substitutes out of plants using more advanced technology. So, for example, you know, that's an area that has more funding, and that's why we didn't go in there. But we kind of found that stuff more promising. So the Impossible Foods, they have this Impossible Burger. It's a veggie burger, but it's like they engineer this heme protein into it, and basically it's like bloody. Even though it's, you know, it's made from vegetables. And that's like, you know, a pretty wild and exciting thing. And that looks like it's got a better path to going cheap than this cultured meat stuff. So, yeah, that's an example of the kind of thing we looked into that might be important, because replacing meat with something synthetic that satisfied people would be a big deal in all the ways I said. Might be neglected. This isn't like the cause that you hear about, you know, most often. And might be tractable. I think tractability is where we have the biggest problem in cultured meat. And we may revisit that, because one of the things I haven't talked about is science. Applying our process to scientific research is super hard, because there's so many layers of expertise you have to go through. Like, you just have so many things that can be only understood by a small number of people. So, you know, as we get better at our processes and our team, we may go back to it. But, you know, currently the view is pretty much what it was. Yep.
I had two other ones, but a follow-up question for that is, how does that tie with, I think you guys gave a grant to Good Food Institute, which
yep.
focuses on cultured meat.
So we did make a grant to the Good Food Institute. The Good Food Institute is a nonprofit that is a general purpose promoter of alternatives to meat. So science on how to make a better alternative to meat, anything that can like help businesses grow, but they're not cultured meat specific. So Good Food Institute, for example, is interested in catalyzing more of this work on like highly advanced technology using vegetable-based foods to be more meat-like, and that's something we're more excited about. So that's the reason. I mean, I think if Good Food Institute had said to us, we do cultured meat, that's what we do, that's all we do, I think we would not have been nearly as interested. We were excited about them as a general purpose org.
Okay.
Can I
ask
a follow-up? Okay. Sure, yeah.
So OPB is much more happy with like high risk, and is that like just high risk in terms of working or not working, or is it also like working or like actively doing lots of harm? And how do you take into account like really bad outcomes in your working?
Sure. I mean, when I say risk, do I mean just the risk of failing to have impact, or do I mean the risk of doing harm? You know, are we okay with the risk of doing harm? I mean, I would say to a degree we're okay with the risk of doing harm. You know, I think in some ways, almost anything you do, and anything you do to try and change the world has a risk of doing harm. I mean, the world is just a complicated place. I could tell you stories about how our top charities might do harm. I could tell you stories, you know, anything we come up with, I could say how it backfires. So I think there's a certain amount of risk. If you want to make the world better, you have to take a certain amount of risk of making it worse, and we're comfortable with that. I do think if we were looking at something where we felt like there was a really big chance that we could really screw things up really badly, and we didn't like feel that we had a great purchase on how to weigh that against the upside. I think that's something where, you know, it's going to come down to the people involved, and especially to the comfort of the donor. But certainly, like, I could imagine that just being something where we might not be up for it. But that hasn't usually. I mean, usually the approach is more to say, you know, do we? The thing we try very hard to do is be as well informed as we can be, to talk to the people who know the most, to have trust networks involving the people who know the most, and to kind of say, you know, according to the best available evidence, reasoning, networks, et cetera, yeah, there are risks here, but like the best available analysis says that the upside is bigger than the risks and that the risks are largely offset by the good things. Usually when we're able to say that, we feel comfortable. I can imagine situations where we wouldn't. And, you know, yeah.
And also, So it's ultimately you and Carrie who will like decide if something is met the grant's name or not.
On a day-to-day basis, that's right. I mean, Dustin is also the funder, and so, you know, he weighs in as well. But
okay,
yeah.
Cool. And so ultimately, there's like a lot of influence, like highly concentrated.
Yep.
Which obviously makes sense. It's Dustin's money.
Yeah.
But like, it could be like that means there's like a high level of pressure on like those values being kind of right. If that makes sense. So
yeah.
Could it make more sense like spread out, like, you know, let grant makers, let the grant proposals actually just make the grants?
Like
the people running your...
The program officers, yeah.
E.g. planning.
Yeah, so this comes down to how decision making is made at OpenPhil. So it's a little bit complex, because I think what we want is we want the people who know the most about a grant to be the ones who are like leading all the thinking, leading the strategy, leading the grant making. And we know that a lot of times the best stuff, because it's bold, because it's neglected, a lot of times the best stuff will be the stuff that's hardest to explain to people who aren't an expert. And so, you know, we have to reconcile that with just like feeling comfortable with what happens. So, you know, a couple principles we follow. One, just general minimization of decision makers is like definitely a principle we follow. You know, although we have a lot of money to give away, we're nowhere close to a government. There's lots of other donors who are just as big. And, you know, in our view, the world is better off when you have lots of institutions following their own visions and their own values with a lot of integrity and a lot of boldness. Then if you, you know, at the other extreme, you could have, like, we could ask everyone in America to vote on everything we do. And, you know, I think that would be a different kind of outcome, a different kind of institution. And so, you know, that's not what we are. I think the place of philanthropy in society is actually more to do things others won't, to try things, to be bold, to go with your values. And because of that, we do try to minimize the number of decision makers. Minimizing that, that's partly also a way of empowering program officers. So program officers are the people like Chloe and Lewis and Jamie who make the decisions about, you know, which grants to recommend. And, you know, the fewer people there are in the way to block them, the more empowered they are. Now, how exactly do we decide all this stuff? That's where we've tried to reach a compromise, because I think, you know, if we literally just had the program officers make all the decisions, I think that would work against just the value of donor understanding what's going on and why. It would work against the value of us making sure we'd made the right decision of which people to empower, how much to empower them, how much money to put into what they're doing. And it, you know, it basically, we would lose track of our ability to make the right high-level decisions about who we're hiring, how much money they're getting, and like how we adjust that over time. And you know, and to lose our knowledge of the situation. On the other hand, you know, if we made everything make, if everything had to make perfect sense to us, I think that would strip away a lot of the good things that program officers could do. Because a lot of times they'll say X, and we'll say, why do you think that? And they'll say, I've been in this field for a long time, and you know, do we have to get all the way up to that convinced? I think that often is gonna be time prohibitive. So what we have at the moment is basically like a compromise. It's sometimes called the 50-40-10 rule, though the numbers can vary from program to program. But you know, the kind of goal is like, out of the amount of money we're looking to spend, we'd like 50% of the dollars to be things where the decision makers, me and Carrie, really get it. It doesn't mean that we like saw everything proven the way it was for GiveWell, but it means that like we're basically convinced that it's a good grant. We understand the case for the grant. We're on board. And then we want another 40% of the dollars, that brings us up to 90 total, to be things where it's like, we could see how that could be a good idea. And so there's a lot of grants that I read where I'm like, I understand how I could think this is good, I don't really get it, and I'm gonna save everyone a lot of time and say yes. And then the 10% is the kind of discretionary part, and so the 10% is basically like, as long as we don't see any show-stopping concerns, as long as we don't see a problem this grant is gonna create for us, if the program officer wants to do it, we'll do it. And so that's, you know, that's basically the, and those numbers can vary a bit, but the basic idea there is that I think that gives program officers the ability to do things that we aren't able to see the case for without making us like totally blind to everything that's going on. And that's just, it's, those numbers don't really come from anywhere principled. They're just numbers that I like. Yeah.
Can you think sort of somewhat longer term, to the extent there are other, say, extremely large donors who sort of seem like, oh, this is the kind of thing that I would want to be doing, how do you think about your relationship with that? Like, is it just you put the stuff online, or is it more you're creating a general process that other people could...
Yeah.
How would they take advantage of that?
Yeah, how might we connect with other big donors who might want to do similar things in the future? I think, you know, having the website is nice, it's useful, it helps people get a general initial idea of how we think. It's also the case that there's just like a ton of information that doesn't go on our website because there's, you know, a lot of the stuff we do can be difficult to explain, it can be controversial, it can be sensitive. It often, you know, often the reason for a grant has to do with like opinions of people. The reason for not a grant has to do with opinions of people. And so what we try and do is we try and share enough info that people can tell how we're thinking. But there's definitely a lot of info that's not up there. And we don't expect people to read every word, and even if they did, we wouldn't expect them to be totally convinced. So, you know, our strategy for reaching interested big donors is more the traditional kind of networking and getting to know each other. And that is something that we have put, you know, low-hanging fruit. I mean, we've had meetings. We've, you know, used our connections to spread the word. We've heard from people who are interested. We've talked to them. I think in the coming year, or maybe in the following year, depending on how much we're able to make it work, we may expand that a bit and put a little bit more focused time. Because I think it's getting, I think for a long time we were making priority areas, we were hiring people, we didn't really have much to say about what we were actually doing. I think our product is a lot more interesting now and a lot easier to talk about with donors. So I think we're getting, I think, a better opportunity to start talking to people. The other thing that I will say is that I think it's a, you know, I think it's definitely in terms of finding a very large donors interested in what we do, obviously there's just like a big component of luck, like, you know, who has that kind of wealth and what are their values. I think there's also a big component of timing, like people who have already done a lot of philanthropy, they sit on a lot of boards, they have a lot of commitments, they're probably not going to change what they're doing. Whereas people who are too early, they're not thinking about philanthropy, it's just hard to engage. So a lot of times it's about, you know, meeting someone at the right time or being there at the right time. And I think with those in mind, I also think that just like the issues are sufficiently deep that I think in a lot of cases, you know, I expect that a lot of our, I do expect and hope that we will have similar relationships with other major donors, but I also expect that any such relationships in many cases will take like years to develop, even after we, you know, meet the people and start talking to them and hear their interest. Yep.
What are the one or two programs or product areas, whether for OpenBuild or GiveWell, that you'd really like to see new in organizations in?
what are the program areas I'd like to see new candidate organizations in? I mean, most of our areas, like, I can tell you some organizations that I'd be happy to see. You know, I think potential risk for advanced AI is definitely, like, an area where we're pretty convinced of the importance of the cause and the issue, but there's not, you know, there's not a lot in the way of grantees. It's kind of an issue that a lot of people don't believe is an issue. And so, you know, that might be my, like, off-the-cuff response of just, if, you know, if we could magically have grantees exist so that we can give them money, that might be where, because I think it's a really important cause, and I think that there's a lot of work people could be doing, but, like, all we can do is fund for the most part, or that's, you know, that's what we try to focus our work on. And so, you know, that's one answer. We wrote a blog post a while ago called Science, Policy, and Infrastructure. I think there's some interesting work at the intersection of science and policy generally, where, you know, the best scientists are often not very policy savvy, and a lot of the best policy people don't really know, like, aren't very deep into science. And so if you could, you know, have policy informed by the best science about how to make science go better and be more useful, I think that, like, I can imagine more than one organization that could work on that that doesn't exist that we might want to fund. So those are some answers. Yeah, Josh again.
So you, I think it was maybe 2 years ago, you talked about redoing the website. And it seemed to take, like, another year and a half, and, like, that there might have been some difficulties there.
Yep.
So can you just talk to that and, like, what, if there were lessons learned or difficulties?
Sure. What took so long with the website? And, you know, and what did we learn from that? You know, I mean, let me think. I don't want to say stuff I shouldn't say, so I can check back. But, you know, I mean, first off, it really is a lot of work. I mean, there is a lot of content there. And, you know, getting all that, it's like, so the experience we had with building a website is we worked with a firm, and there was kind of like, step one was getting the look and feel, the skin, the layout, the organization, and that, like, just took a ton of our time, and it was a ton of, like, my time, and a ton of Ellie's time, and a ton of other people's time, who are very senior at the organization, because that website is our public face. And so, you know, if someone had come along and made us, We like a bright pink website and said, this is really pretty. But it didn't communicate what we were. It didn't look sober enough or serious enough. You know, that would be a problem. And so, you know, in order to just, like, really be a part of these decisions and make sure that we're being represented in a way we're comfortable with, we had to be really involved in that. And because our time is, like, scarce, it often just, like, took a long time to get through all the decisions it took to make that. And then there's, like, a ton of decisions to make. I mean, you know, there's a lot of content on these websites. So GiveWell has its charities and its intervention reports and its, you know, pages about the research methodology. And there's just, like, you can click and click and click. And to think about how each page should look, how it's going to fit into that. OpenPhil doesn't have as much content. And so, you know, step two was, like, once we had the basics down, it was just a lot of details about how everything links together and how everything works, and there were a lot of bugs that just had to be, like, slowly discovered and iterated on. And in a lot of cases, the people who were needed to weigh in on something, you know, had other priorities, so it wasn't like we were, like, coming back to it every day. So we started this process at the beginning of 2015. OpenPhil website went live at the end of 2015, so that was about a year, and that was quicker because there was less content. And it was more urgent. I mean, OpenPhil didn't have a website. And then GiveWell took, like, you know, 2 years. So, I mean, that's, you know, basically the situation. I mean, what did we learn? I mean, I've definitely learned lessons about just, like, how to do this process next time that I don't think are, like, super interesting or important that I won't go into here. But a big picture thing, I mean, I wouldn't say we learned it, but I would say it reinforced it, which is that, you know, you can't just outsource outreach. So, you know, when anything that involves promoting ourselves and going out there and making the case for ourselves, it's just hard to do that without senior staff being involved. It doesn't just cost money, it costs time. It costs more time than we expected. It continues to be the case that we're just cautious about expanding that stuff too aggressively because our bread and butter is research. That's where our focus is. And as long as we aren't, you know, short on money, I think that, like, a lot of times that is what we choose to prioritize because it's just, it's not cheap or easy to get, you know, even something like a website. It seems like you should be able to pay someone to do it, but I really strongly feel we're not able to do that. Kat, do you have anything to add?
So I worked on the tail end of it. I got involved with the website relaunch in, like, May, and we launched in September. So basically just
once she got involved, it was quick.
Yeah.
basically seconding everything Holden said about all the little details. Like, we did some amount of content, like, rewriting to, like, update, like, processes that had changed and, like, noticing when things were out of date and, like, flagging that they were out of date. As Holden mentioned, like, that just turned out to be an enormous project because Gitmodel has existed for almost 10 years and has always been, like, a really heavy content producer. So, pretty much seconded to Holden.
Also, a lot of like decisions. I mean, there's just like a zillion things on the website where it's like, we could fix this thing. It will take a long time. Is it worth it? And those are just decisions that, you know, it's hard to have those made at a junior level. And so, yeah. Yep.
So just like, have you ever looked into infrastructure and how do you think about that? Because I just think it's been very interesting. Like, I was in Sierra Leone and like, seems like nothing will happen without it. It's really hard to fundraise for.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, how do we think about infrastructure? Do you mean stuff like roads and electricity?
Yeah.
Yeah, so something that we, I mean, the bucket I would put that in, I would say just in terms of the evolution of OpenPhil so far, we looked at causes and we chose causes in the policy sphere, in the kind of like advocating for better policy, and in the global catastrophic risk sphere, because those were two areas where we thought we understood how to pick best causes or, you know, how to try to. And thought we would learn a lot and didn't already know a lot. And two areas that we've been a lot slower about and are gonna be a lot slower coming are scientific research. Like, what lines of scientific research should we be trying to support? Because that's just such a daunting problem in terms of having the right staff and the right expertise. And we did, you know, we finally did hire two senior scientific staff like late this summer. They started late this summer. So I think we are, you know, we're moving on that. It's a tough one. And then the other thing is global health and development. So just looking, you know, kind of looking abroad at things we might do to help people in global poverty that are not like Gitmodel top charities, things that are higher risk. That's where I put the infrastructure thing. And it hasn't been as high a priority for OpenPhil, partly because we do feel like, you know, that's an area that we're already doing a fair amount of work in via GiveWell or that we're connected to. And partly just because it's also, you know, there's a lot of depth to it and there's a lot of things to look at and we're not exactly sure how to go about it. And, you know, we have enough else going on. So it's like, for now, our priority is really, you know, we have some focus areas. We want to get better at the underlying framework and process and staff behind making grants in them before expanding out a lot more. So that's a long story as to why, you know, there's kind of these big buckets of causes that we just haven't really gotten all the way to yet. And we've kind of looked at them a little bit and had a few conversations, but that's about it. Yep.
I'm curious, you just mentioned that to scientific staff, what are their backgrounds?
Sure, so we recently, you know, earlier this year, I think it was in August or so, maybe July, Chris Somerville, he's a professor at Berkeley. He's on leave right now. And he's a plant biologist, so was very involved in the development of Arabidopsis as a plant model. So this is sort of the, you know, there are certain animals that people study a lot in the lab because they're kind of simple and easy to study and everyone else studies them. This is the thing that people use for like simple plants. And that's, you know, he's also done industry. He has quite a broad wealth of experience. And then at his recommendation, we also hired Heather Youngs, also comes to us from Berkeley. Basically hired her because they have a good working relationship. They've worked together for a long time. And like, she was a strong recommendation. So like, in terms of the backgrounds, in terms of our process, you know, I mean, as usual, we like interviewed a lot of people. We looked for certain qualities, like especially people who could help us work through problems we're having and be able to communicate about what we should do in terms that we found convincing and that we could understand. That was like a big thing we looked for because that's what these, you know, that's what these employees do. And then we also hired, you know, a more junior scientist as well. So that was a recent thing. And, you know, we were kind of doing that search on and off, but mostly on for about a year before we made any of those hires. Does that answer your question? Cool. Yep.
Can you speak to that at a very base level? What sets open philanthropy apart from a foundation like Gates or Rockefeller or any of those?
Sure. What sets open philanthropy apart from Gates or Rockefeller or things like those? So, you know, there's basically three key distinguishing factors, in my opinion. So it's one key difference is that the Gates Foundation's official purpose and reason for existing is to find things that Bill Gates likes. Our purpose is to find things that, you know, are the best ways to help people according to our best judgment. those are, you know, maybe a little bit more similar missions than they sound, because like my judgment and Carrie Tuna's judgment are like very involved in those decisions, but they are different missions. And you know, our ambition is to kind of be arriving at answers that other people would agree with if they had the same kind of goal of doing the most good, and if they reflected sufficiently much on them. And so, you know, ultimately when there's like a judgment call about how to do the most good and it's really unclear how, then sometimes we have to make a guess, and sometimes personal values come into that. And ultimately the donor has to be comfortable with everything they do, and that can affect things as well. But, you know, the overall driving mission is like, we're all trying to do the most good. That's the mission statement. And then that, you know, that leads to one sense of openness, with the word open, that being that we're, you know, we try to choose our causes, choose our focus areas in a way that causes us to do the most good. So your normal foundation, actually the advice we got over and over again when we were getting started was, when you do philanthropy, the first thing you have to do is pick a cause that you're passionate about, that you're personally passionate about, and then you can start doing all the analysis to figure out how to do the best work. And we really have gone kind of the opposite way around, where we've said, you know, the first thing we want to do is investigate causes, not pick a cause, until we've learned more and until we've tried to estimate how much good we can do in each one. And so it's that, you know, I don't know any other foundation that looked at a lot of causes, rated them on importance, neglect, and distractibility, looked at the broad variety of causes we're looking at, and had that kind of framework and tried to do that. So I think, you know, in some sense, it's sometimes people used intuitions where they said, this seems like a really important problem. And in some cases, people made really excellent choices, in my opinion. But I think it is a different driving mission. And so then, you know, I think that's one real key. And I think that also relates back to, you know, the effective altruism community and its values. Like, I think if you're looking for a large funder that has kind of effective altruist values, do the most good with the resources you have, I do think we are, you know, we fit that bill more than others, and we have more of a connection to that community more than others, and that's, you know, I think that makes sense. Then there's the information sharing, and that's related as well. You know, just wanting people to be able to follow our thought process and our real thought process. So I think most foundations, most public communications is PR and marketing. And, you know, most of our communications, we're just trying to explain why we did what we did. So, yeah, those are really the key differences in my view. Yeah, what do I think is the relationship between individual donors and top charities in OpenPhil in the future? I mean, I think GiveWell is like a really good resource, in my opinion, the best resource for someone who wants to give to charity and does not want to kind of like personally become an expert in it and doesn't have some other expert that they trust in it. And so GiveWell will try to continue to be a service to people like that. I also think, by the way, I mean, having looked at a zillion things, I think the top charities are really good. Like by any standard, they're really good giving opportunities. Sometimes I think we can do better with the money we're giving away. Sometimes I think we can't, but it's never obvious to me. And I think the top charities are really good and, you know, have, I mean, basically Good Ventures is still giving large amounts there every year. But, you know, I think that like primary purpose of GiveWell is to serve that kind of donor. And then I think there's another kind of donor that, you know, they might be more willing to trust someone. And so I think if you know a person you trust and they tell you where to give and you really feel like they know what they're talking about, you may end up acting very differently. And if that person is at OpenPhil, then, or, you know, or you generally just trust the thought process of OpenPhil, then you may want to give, you know, to the OpenPhil pot of money. And that's something that like logistically is not really a thing right now, but will be in the future. We have to complete the spinoff first. And then, you know, I think there's a third kind of donor that really wants to build up their own expertise. And I think that kind of person, we can help them learn, we can help advise them, and that's pretty much all we do. Does that kind of address your question? Cool. Yep.
So in regard to the last question, I think like Dustin is like $9 billion or so, and you're giving like $100 million a year or something?
So I'm not going to talk about their net worth. You can see what Google thinks if you want. I'm estimating this year's OpenPhil giving somewhere in the ballpark of $100 million. Yeah.
So like, will it, in the foreseeable future, will it ever be the case that like if a small donor donates money to OpenPhil, that's actually going to increase the amount of money that goes out, or is it just going to like or you're just going to extend like the life of their
yeah. Life? I think by default, if an individual gave to the open fill pool of money, that like effectively you're giving to like giving way out in the future when we have spent more time figuring out what we want to do, and then we've gotten to the point where we're actually money constrained. Right now we're trying to move more slowly than that, and deliberately so. I think we're a ways away from like that dollar getting spent if you put it in that pool. I think that's definitely the case. And that would be one thing to consider if you're thinking about giving there. And a good reason not to give there this year, which hey, you can't, so. Yeah, Jake.
Can you talk about how you set the amount that Good Ventures was going to give to top charities? And then also, if you have thoughts on the impact of the elections on your US policy areas.
The impact of what?
The election on your US policy areas.
Great. Two of the toughest questions possible. I've got 3 minutes. All right, let's see. So how did we set the amount given to top charities? So, you know, it was a really tough, I mean, spent most of the year trying to ramp up grant making. And when it came time to think about how much to recommend that Good Ventures give to top charities, we're going to have quite a lengthy couple of blog posts on this. It really hit me how many questions play into this. One quick thing to say is like one key question you want to consider is if you give a dollar to AMF or if you don't, you could think of that as either, you know, in the first world you give the dollar to AMF and AMF spends it on bed nets. And the second case, what really ends up happening to that dollar is what I was responding to Avi, the dollar gets sort of saved and effectively adds to the pool of money at the end, much later. And so how you compare those two, I call this the last dollar question. In other words, is giving to AMF better than the last dollar OpenPhil is going to spend from the pool of currently available capital? If AMF is better than the last dollar, that argues for kind of spending more this year and trying to fill that funding gap and take all the opportunities you're going to have to spend that money. If AMF is worse than the last dollar, that argues for not giving to AMF this year because you can instead save that money. It'll do more good later. I think that a couple caveats to this are, one, the last dollar question is like totally vexing and impossible to answer with any kind of confidence. And when I did try to go through it, you know, a lot of it was things like, well, if I decide that I actually care about chickens a reasonable fraction as much as humans, then probably the last dollar is going to be to AMF. Because we'll find things to do that are, you know, with animals, could probably find enough things to do. But if I don't decide that, and then, so now I'm trying to think about what I'm gonna think about chickens in 10 years. So, you know, lots of questions like that come up. If I write down all the questions I'm facing and I take my best guess at the probabilities of everything, and I look through everything, I can come to an answer, but the answer is very shaky. And so then you get to a bunch of other second order questions, such as, you know, if you do think AMF is better than the last dollar, does that mean you want to ramp giving up all the way, give $200 million or whatever it is? I actually don't know the total room for funding. Yeah, I don't know. You know, and basically take down all the recommendations from the GiveWell website. Or, you know, and then know that if you change your mind next year, that you decide you like chickens next year, that you're now going to like ramp it down to zero again and all the top charities are going to be like, you know, laying people off left and right. Do you want to do that? I think not. And also, you know, you've got this issue with kind of pushing other donors out, which I've talked about in the past, which I'm not going to feature as much this year. And then, you know, if you do decide that AMF is worse than the last dollar, does that mean you want to take giving to AMF to zero this year? It was a lot last year. That, I think, creates its own kind of problems and poses its own kind of issues. So for a variety of reasons, you know, I partly just value smoothing our thinking a bit and not moving too erratically, especially not reducing budgets too erratically when our judgment is like really shaky and can change a lot. And then there's a bunch of other considerations that get kind of gnarly that will be up on our blog post. But you know, the bottom line was that my best guess right now is that I think the expected value of what we can do with the last dollar is better than top charities. It's really shaky. I really am not confident in that. And that called for a lower amount to top charities, but I didn't want it to be too much lower than it was last year. And so that, and also like a lot of times when we don't know what to do, we pick round numbers so that we're not communicating things we don't intend to communicate. So, you know, that $50 million figure compared to $70 million last year, that's kind of, you know, that's not all the reasoning. That's some of it. If you want to read more, there will be stuff up. Okay, how did the election affect? I think the election, I mean, we purposefully chose cause areas that, like, you know, seemed especially important, neglected, and tractable. And also, we often work on long time horizons. So, like, a lot of times in policy, our goal is to kind of put an idea on the map, put it on the agenda, build institutions, build fields, build knowledge, so that if there's a later policy opportunity, maybe 10 years from now, you've got everyone ready to take advantage of it. So because of the long time frame to work on, and because we didn't pick the world's most classic, you know, toxic red versus blue issues, because those don't tend to be very neglected and they really don't tend to be very tractable, you know, I feel the set of causes we took is not like massively affected here. I think on criminal, and it's something we're still thinking through. So it's something, you know, this is not a final answer, but I would say in criminal justice reform, you know, odds look like they've changed for federal reform, but that was never our main focus. State and local level, it's not really clear that the situation is like super duper different. I don't think this really affects biosecurity and pandemic preparedness one way or the other very much. I don't think it affects farm animal welfare very much. I think the implications for artificial intelligence are obvious. I don't see a way in which, you know, I basically think it's unclear and or no real change for most of the stuff we do. So that's my quick answer, but it's definitely something we're still reflecting on. And there are a lot of little things, you know, things that maybe this was possible before and now it's not because there's a new administration, new set of people, or maybe something was not possible and now it is. But at a high level, I don't think we need to retool everything. And I think given just like the slow long-term nature of everything we do, right? You pick causes, then you hire people, then you get to know everyone, then you ramp up your grant making. You can't turn on a dime. I think we'd be screwing up if we were making decisions that had to be like totally, you know, ripped up and start over every time there's an election that goes differently than someone might expect. All right, taking one last question from Colin.
On the election stuff, they carry in and got some gate and $20 million or a number sort of like that to the game from, so that, you know, sort of, you know, I guess it wasn't done. But anyway, you know, sort of picking aside on the red-blue divides, I mean, how do you see, is Open Philanthropy trying to sort of stay separate from that, to sort of, to, is that a sort of a commitment to sort of stay away from, you know, overtly partisan stuff? Or?
So Open Phil doesn't do electioneering because 501c3 public charities can't do that, so we're not, you know, we don't comment on, like, we don't comment on, we don't advise on, we don't give on, like, trying to get one candidate in office rather than another. That's just outside of what we can do as a C3. We're part of GiveWell. That may change in the future because we are spinning off into a different kind of vehicle that does not have that restriction. So, you know, that's why we don't get into that.
I mean, lots of parties, I think most people say it's a partisan organization. That's a C3.
Oh, so there's definitely, I mean, there's a large number of issues where we take a position, and we took the position because we think it's the best thing for humanity, the best thing for people, but the position is clearly identified with the right or the left. I mean, there's, and actually, we're not always on the right, we're not always on the left, from across our different issues. Sometimes we're on one side, sometimes we're on the other side. We're not afraid of being partisan in that sense. I mean, we're definitely, you know, happy to make the case that policy should be a certain way because that's good for people. And if that policy happens to be what the left wants and what the right hates, or it happens to be what the right wants and the left hates, that's fine. We'll still do it. So we're not afraid of being partisan in that way. But we, you know, we don't get involved in, like, elections. That's not something we can do. Cool. Well, I will stick around to chat for a bit. But again, thanks everyone for coming. It was a really fun conversation, and hopefully we'll see you next time.